I have the pleasure of introducing today Dr. Scott Giller. Dr. Giller is a senior partner of Safety Performance Solutions. He is an alumni distinguished professor and director of the Center for Applied Behavior Systems at Virginia Tech. He has authored and co-authored 36 books, 82 book chapters, 39 training manuals, 259 magazine articles, and over 300 research articles addressing the development and evaluation of behavioral change interventions to improve the quality of life. He is a fellow of the American Psychological Association, the Association of Psychological Science, and the World Academy of Productivity and Quality Sciences. He is past editor of the Journal of Applied Behavioral Analysis, 89 to 92, current associate editor of Environment and Behavior since 1982, and current consulting editor for the Behavior and Social Issues, the Journal of Organizational Behavior Management, and the Journal of Safety Research. Dr. Giller has received Lifetime Achievement Awards for the American Psychological Foundation and the International Organizational Behavior Management Network. At the College of Worcester graduation ceremonies in May 2011, Dr. Giller was awarded the honorary degree, Doctor of Humane Letters. Here is Dr. Giller.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And it's 4 o'clock, the day is ending, and you people come to this session. Thank you very much. How many were at the preceding session in this room with Krista, my daughter? I mean, that's just a hard act to follow. I'm really emotional. What is it for a parent to sit and watch your kid get up there, and then they were telling her, you did better than your dad. You were better than your dad, you know? People who had seen me speak before. How many have never heard me talk before at a conference? Oh, I got some new folks here. That's what I love, new folks. But some folks came back. Some folks who've heard me talk before. Okay, so let me explain. I'm a psychologist. I started my 50th year at Virginia Tech this year. Professor of psychology. I'll tell you, I don't know anything about engineering, but I know something about people. I know something about human dynamics. And I'm going to talk science to you. It's not common sense. My daughter did a great job in the preceding session explaining that your common sense is biased. It's biased. We have confirmation bias. We have people in line all night because they believe in one way. And we have other people who, what are they, two different ways, CNN and Fox News. We have different ways of seeing the world. That's science. So I'm here to tell you, well, that's common sense. I'm here to tell you what the science says about injury prevention, about sustaining an injury-free workplace. In fact, I'm going to put it in terms of 7 C's so you can remember this. And I'm going to begin with the end in mind. And by the way, let me just tell you this too. If you're interested in these PowerPoints, just leave me a business card and I will get it to you. But I also want to say that my presentation here was published last month in Professional Safety. Anybody see this in Professional Safety? So good, you've already seen it, maybe you haven't read it closely, but it's published, and I appreciate that too, because I want you guys to learn this stuff. And I want you to hear me as a teacher. Not me the teacher, you the teacher. We don't have, this room is not filled, but you've come to listen, but to learn, but I want you to teach others, because we're talking about important stuff. I want to begin with the end in mind. Check out this diagram. This is the diagram that puts it all together. Many people are using this C word these days, culture. Oh, it's about the culture. And some academics want to argue, is it the climate or is it the culture? Let's just talk culture. And many of us believe, I believe, that our culture is determined by our conversation, by our communication. And our communication influences our culture. So check it out. I've got communication right here in the center. That's one of the 7 C words, communication. And then I've got these other C words. Check this out. Communication, I got choice, competence, and community. Three more C words. How important are they if I'm telling you that they will determine whether you're self-motivated or not? How important is it to be self-motivated? Not doing it because somebody else is holding you accountable, but you're holding yourself accountable. Think about that. So I'm going to teach you, and you're going to teach others, how to get people to feel self-motivated. And it all hangs together, see? And then, over here, I've got commitment. Well, we had folks committed last night, slept all night in line for the big thing happening. I guess it's 4 o'clock today or something. And so you talk about commitment, we're going to talk about commitment. Because what if we had that kind of a commitment for safety? And then we're going to talk about it takes courage. And here's a big word right here, compassion. Empathy. First, compassion is the action from empathy, right here. So these, I'm telling you folks, these 7 C words. So let's check it out. But before I go any further, I always like to reference my heroes. Where am I coming from? I'm not telling you stuff that was only my idea. It came from research. And it came from, well, there's B.F. Skinner on the left. Anybody know who's on the right? W. Edwards Deming. I went to a 4-day workshop, and Deming was the speaker for 4 days. He was 91 years old. This was in Cincinnati. He had just suffered a stroke, so he didn't speak that clearly, but he blew me away. He changed my paradigm. I was believed totally in behavioral science, but Deming was a humanist. And he made me believe that we have to combine what we know from behavioral science with what we know from humanism, bring them together. So if someone asks, what was this Geller talking about? I'm talking about humanistic behaviorism. Who took a psychology class? Remember psychology? Remember back then it was Carl Rogers in humanism and Abraham Maslow over here, and it was B.F. Skinner and Fred Keller and his followers over here, and they were treated and taught, and we still teach it as separate. I went to bring them together. Does it take humanism to make behavioral science more effective? Behavior-based safety? How many heard the term behavior-based safety? I'm proud to say I started that in 1979. But I didn't teach it the way some people are implementing it. Because people are not doing the whole process. We'll talk about that. Skinner. Let's see what Skinner was telling us. One can picture a good life by analyzing one's feelings, but can achieve it only by arranging environmental contingencies. Break it down, 3 words. Selection by consequences. We do what we do for what we expect to get for doing it. Or sometimes we do things to avoid aversive consequences. Sometimes we're success seekers, sometimes we're failure avoiders. But the bottom line is, it's consequences. Have you seen these self-help, read these self-help books that say, you can do anything you want to be. Just say you're the greatest. Just all about self-affirmation. Remember that? Say, I can do this. Not true. Without consequences. If you don't see the fruits of your labor, we have extinction. The behavior will stop. So that's what Skinner taught us. He also said immediate consequences outweigh delayed consequences. Well, we've all been there. That's why safety is tough. Because we want people to do things right now, but they don't get anything. Oh, it's to prevent something that might happen in the future. How tough is that? You know what it takes? Here's a word from humanism, emotional intelligence. We have to really think about the possibility. Not easy. And Skinner said, it's not easy. And he also said this, consequences for the individual usually outweigh consequences for others. That's just not safety. You have to think as safety professionals that it is about consequences for others that you're concerned with, right? So we could say, that's wrong, man. That's wrong. We have to get to beyond these quotes. Paul Chance, an educator in my field, in fact, wrote an article, said, to save the world, we have to prove Skinner wrong. I'm telling you right now, begin with the end in mind, not true. What if helping others was rewarding to you? What if it really is better to give than to receive? Have you all heard that? You've been there, haven't you? As safety professionals, you felt the good feelings of helping somebody. Am I right? Our challenge is to get other people to see that. Huh? To get the other people to see, you know, it is better to give than to receive, and you don't need those consequences right away. I love this quote that Skinner said. I'm telling you what, I wrote a book in 1982 all about this. Most thoughtful people agree the world is in serious trouble. Fossil fuel will not last forever, and many other critical resources are nearing exhaustion. The earth grows steadily less inhabitable, and all this is exacerbated by a burgeoning population that resists control. The timetable may not be clear, but the threat is real. That many people have begun to find a recital of these dangers tiresome is perhaps an even greater threat. 87. When I wrote my first textbook in 1982, it's called Preserving the Environment. And I know this is not exactly safety, but it reflects what worries me. They said, if we don't turn it around in 40 years, that was in 1982, the experts were saying. But now, some of us are just denying it, you know? Some of us are just saying, it's not true, global warming doesn't happen. We're even denying science. But Deming says, don't blame people. Don't blame people for problems created by the system. Behavior-based safety used to get a bad rap because it sounded as if we're blaming people. We're blaming employees for their behavior. And some consultants actually taught it that way, claiming that 98% of all the injuries are caused by behavior. That's why you have to buy our program. It's just not true. Behavior-based safety studies the situation that influences behavior. You can't measure everything. This rocked my boat, because I always heard you can't manage what you can't measure. If you want to manage something, you have to measure it. And that's true. Managers hold us accountable by measuring our behavior. Ah, but leaders inspire us to be self-motivated. Before you leave here today, you're going to walk out of here knowing what it takes to be a leader. And anybody can be a leader. What does it take to be a leader to inspire self-motivation? We need managers. I need them in my life. They hold me accountable. They hold me accountable, and I need that. But we all can be leaders. And they get their position assigned. They have that management position assigned. But leaders inspire us to go beyond the call of duty. Self-motivation. You'll know how to do that. A numerical goal without a method is nonsense. I mean, Deming must have said this 3 times a day, 4 days. What could be worse? Goal without method. At the time, I wasn't really into what does that mean, but now I know. How often do we set a goal without teaching people how to reach that goal? And how silly is it to say zero is our goal? I mean, seriously, I want to talk seriously about our language in safety. We talk in safety not only wrong, but it's a turnoff. Zero injury-free is your vision. You set goals on things you do on a daily basis to reach that vision. And as Krista mentioned in a prior session, you set SMARTS goals. Let me just run through it quickly. Specifically, what will you do? M, motivational. Oh, not measurable, motivational. You should set a goal with a realization of what you're going to get by achieving that goal. A, it's achievable. I believe it's a stretch goal, but I believe we can get there. R, it's relevant. This goal that we've set is relevant, related to achieving zero. SMAR. T, trackable. I can track my progress in reaching that goal. And the last one, I've added an S. Share it. Tell other people your goal. this is what I intend to do, specifically to reach a vision someday. Ranking people, teams, or divisions induces conflict, destroys morale, and prevents optimization. This also changed my paradigm, because I'm a competitive kind of person, and I believe that I do my best, but I believe in social comparison, right? I compare my situation with others, and I want to try to be the best. And sometimes we're over the top with that regard. You go to buy a car, for example, and you get a salesperson assigned to you, and if you go back the next day and he or she is not there, you don't get service because this salesperson is your person, and that commission is theirs. Deming says that does not optimize the system. It's about interdependent rather than independent. I know we come into this world dependent on others to take care of us. Then we can't wait to become teenagers because then we are independent. Right? We're too old to do what kids do, too young to do what adults do, so we do what anyway nobody wants us to do. Independent. And sometimes we're stuck there. We're stuck. The mature audience, the mature organization, the mature individual, interdependent. We're in this together. Can I help you? No, I can do it myself. No, thank you. Thank you for helping me. People support that which they helped to create. How simple. And as you see, it's your common sense. You've been there. So how often have rules and regulations and procedures been passed down to you, supervisors telling you what to do, rather than switch it around? The supervisor might know what he or she wants you to do, but how about asking the individual, hey, how should we do this? Chances are they'll come up with something very similar to what you wanted. But if you help to create the process, if you had some input, by the way, one of the C words is choice. If you believe you had some choice in this situation, you're more likely to be self-motivated. Here's my favorite one of all. In God we trust, all others bring data. You know, without data, you're a jerk with an opinion. And how many opinions are out there? How many people rely on opinion to do the right thing? My opinion. As Krista said, my premature cognitive commitment, my confirmation bias. What I'm sharing with you is data. And I'm not showing off, I'm not selling books, but I simply want to say that this has evolved. There's my first book on the psychology of safety. And then later on we had the psychology of safety handbook. This is all based on research, data. Then I moved from behavior-based safety to people-based safety. And there, Krista and I just published last year the latest book. Notice the title, Actively Caring for People's Safety. And it is data-driven. And the book right now just came out. Cassandra's holding it up. I gave her a copy earlier. And that book is available at the website. And by the way, it's $25. I mean, it's not about making money. It's about making a difference. I am frustrated. By the way, Deming was frustrated. In 91, he was cantankerous. Why? I talked with him later. He was frustrated because people weren't getting it. They weren't listening to what he knows from research. And I'm feeling the same way. I walk around and I see people using language that's inappropriate. And I've been saying it for years. I'll give you an example. 30 years ago, I said, safety is not a priority. It's a value. Yet I heard the word priority used this morning in the keynote. Please, would you teach people? If you call safety a priority, it gets shifted like every other priority. Call it a value. When you get ready for work in the morning, you got your priorities, huh? Got your priorities that you do? What do? You know, you brush your teeth and you have breakfast. Suppose you have less time. The alarm or the opportunity clock didn't go off. Do you change your priorities? Sure, might miss breakfast. Might save one of those, you know, they call it the four S's. We shower, we shave, you shampoo, and you brush your teeth. But so, shine your shoes. That's an S word, shine your shoes. But suppose you have less time. Maybe you wait for work to do one of those S's, you know? But there's something you do every morning. You never miss. It's not a priority. What do you do? In fact, it's so real and it's personal. This is personal. But everyone in this room did it before you walked out the door. What did you do? You got dressed. You covered up. You covered up. That's a value. That's what safety needs to be. And by the way, I apologize if some of you have heard me say this before, and I've been saying it for years. Why isn't the public getting it? Why aren't we getting it on airplanes? Safety is our number one priority. Sorry. She needs feedback. What do you mean I'm disconnected and out of touch? I have email, a smartphone, text messaging, Facebook, and a blogger. A blog. And this is our technology. But we're not connecting. We're not communicating. We're not really showing empathy. The power of interpersonal communication. Check it out. This is what communication does. Why am I saying communication is so important? Look, it builds interpersonal connections and trust. How important it is to have a culture of people trusting each other. How do we resolve conflict? Communication. In fact, communication also causes conflict. It brings reality to intangibles. I mean, really, what is love? Except through communication can we understand what these words mean. So I'm just trying to show you how powerful is this C word, communication. It defines our culture, as I said. It enables breakthroughs on positive change. Only through communication can we break through for change. As Krista covered in our prior session, the value of accepting change. Not easy. It influences our self-esteem. It influences how we feel about ourselves. It influences your sense of competence, thus your self-motivation. When you believe you're competent at doing worthwhile work, you're more likely to go beyond the call of duty, not because someone's holding you accountable, you're holding yourself accountable. Then we have intrapersonal communication, you know, talking to yourself. This is too good to be true. This can't possibly last. How many, here's the question, how many in this room masturbate? I must do this. And then, when you don't get it all done, you shoot on yourself. I should have done this. I should have done it this way. I should. That's negative self-talk. And that can turn you off. Intrapersonal. Interpersonal is with others. Interpersonal is communication to yourself. And here's the big one, folks. Man, I heard this morning. Can we please stop with the word accident? The Department of Transportation, 30 years, said, don't call it it's a crash. It's a collision. Because what's the word accident mean? I couldn't help it. It implies chance. It implies a loss of control. I've actually worked in organizations years ago where they said, when it's your time, it's your time. I don't have much control over the situation. That's because of that word accident. Gives people, by the way, I know you're using the word incident. Thank you for doing that. But you know what an incident really is? An intentional act. The shooting at Virginia Tech, April 16th, 2007. Krista knew 10 of those folks. That was an incident. Why don't we just say injury or mishap? It's an injury. Yes, our president several years ago fell down some stairs. Maybe some of you are old enough to remember this. And this is what he said. It was just an accident. This was in newspapers worldwide. And accidents happen to people. That's what he said. When it's your time, it's your time. Restraints. I mean, really, we used to call them occupant restraints. Let's everybody put on their occupant restraint. The language we use influences our behavior and influences our culture. But it's not a seat belt. It's a life belt. But call it a safety belt if you want. At least you're implying what it is. Matter of fact, a seat belt just goes around your waist. Maybe on an airplane it's a seat belt. But my vehicle has a lap, a shoulder strap. Why don't we call it a safety belt? So check out these words. Which one do you like better? Behavior modification. By the way, that was my field. I taught the first course at Virginia Tech. It was called behavior modification. Come to my class and learn how to modify the behavior of others. People didn't like to hear that. But that's really what it is. We teach you behavioral science. We teach behavioral science so you can change, benefit, influence the behavior of others. But a better word, behavior-based intervention. Is it a seatbelt or a safety belt? Is it an airbag or a safety cushion? It's not even filled with air, folks. You know? Is it peer pressure or peer support? How we talk. Is it a program or a process? See, a program has a beginning and an end. Okay, it'll be over, another flavor of the month, and what's the next program going to be? It's an ongoing process. Is it training or coaching? Oh, at the top, what jumped up? Is it a mandate or is it an expectation? Is it loss control or injury prevention? Is it compliance or commitment? Is it an alarm clock or opportunity clock? Krista doesn't buy into that one, but nevertheless. I got to do this or I get to do this. You know, I ask my students, I teach a class of 600. Actually, one class of 600, another class of 500. It's introductory psychology. The first day I ask my students, how many are here to avoid failure? Most of them raise their hand. And I say, I'm glad you're here. Thank you. It means you're motivated. But I bet you told your friends you got to go to class, not I get to go to class. It's a requirement, not an opportunity. And it's your mindset. Talk to yourself, I get to do this. Man, at my age, I'm so grateful I'm still here. I'm so grateful I can still talk to you all. And that's my mindset. My students say, Doc, why are you so happy, man? Why are you always so happy? In fact, I get depressed because you seem to always be so happy. I'm not always that happy, but I want to show it off. You know what? You can talk yourself. You can act yourself into feeling better. I saw this cartoon several years ago, Charlie Brown. He's walking like this with his head down. When you're depressed, you got to walk like you're depressed. Turn it around. Walk like you're great. Walk like you're inspired. Walk like you're enthusiastic, and you'll feel better. And then look at it flipped around. Is it behavior-based safety, or is it actively caring for people? As I said earlier, we all care, but let's actively care. And that's humanistic behaviorism. Well, it's all in how you define relations. We all know that. Words can be self-serving. Let's talk about communication. There are five kinds of communication. I think you'll relate to this because you've been there. At the very bottom, the foundation is relationship building. That's the kind of communication when you're walking by and you say, how you doing? You say, great. That's just a hi. Relationship communication is when you know something about that person and you can ask something about their family or about their situation or how are you feeling. I've had several people come up to me at this conference and ask me, how's my cancer? That's heavy, man, because they remember that I've been dealing with this and they're getting personal with me. That's relationship building. Then there's possibility. By the way, have you noticed that when you meet somebody for the first time, it's about relationships, isn't it? You talk about the past. I've been there. Yeah, you've been there too. So you talk about where have you been? Where have we might have crossed paths? So when we start a communication with a new person, it's usually about the past. And then, if you want that communication to make a difference, where do you go next? To the present or the future? I'm suggesting the future. This is where we've been. Yes, we've not been as actively caring as we could be. We've had some difficulties, but I'll tell you what. What's the vision? What's the possibility? What would you like to see happen in our relationship? We've had some difficulties, so where are we going? What would you like to see happen? And then after you talk about the possibility, now you get back to the present. Given where we want to go, given our vision, zero injuries, what do we do now? What's the action? Then you have to talk about opportunities. Where are the opportunities to do what we should do to bring us to that vision? And finally, don't forget follow-up. I suggest to you that these five levels of communication say it all with regard to building a culture of interdependent caring. But it starts with relationship building. It starts with helping people realize that you care about them. My wife says I never listen to her. Or at least I think that's what she said. Let's talk about listening. It occurs at five levels. First, we get ignored. You ever get ignored? Press one to be ignored. Press two to be ignored longer. I mean, we feel ignored. Little kids feel ignored. No. Sometimes we pretend. Thank you all for pretending, but I know you might be thinking of dinner or something else. It's been a long day, but I'm looking around. Hey, you know, some of you are giving me body language that you're there. Thank you. Maybe you're doing more than pretend, but here's the kind of this happens all the time. Selective listening. Have you ever heard the term selective perception? It's redundant. All perception is selective. Biased. Confirmation bias. I'll say that probably two more times when we're done, because it does bother me. But it's true. We are influenced by our biases. That is your common sense. That looks like a windshield to me, Doc. I mean, that's what he sees from his past. No, honey, not I saw the table. It's I have seen a table. No, the kid saw the table. But mom is not looking at it from his perspective. By the way, that's empathy. Easier said than done. Take the time. It's not efficient. It's effective. And there's a difference. To be effective, find out where the other person is coming from. When you want to give someone corrective feedback, we've been talking a lot about corrective feedback. Ask more questions. Instead of telling them, that's unsafe, that's at risk, that's, say, how would you do it? Is there a better way to do that? Ask more questions. Then we have attentive. I mean, this is when I'm looking around and it seems like you're attentive. You're taking notes and you're listening in, so thank you. Aha, Biff, guess what? After we go to the drugstore or the post office, I'm going to the vets to get tutored. He wasn't actively listening. And at the top, we got empathic listening. Empathy. Here's a picture. He's got a hat, depending on the person. Let me tell you, empathy is easier said than done. Let me tell you how I learned about empathy. 1974, I'm teaching a class of 400 students. And in those days, I took exams in blue books. Anybody remember the blue books? Oh, you're nodding your head. Yeah. I paid 20 cents for this blue book. Today, back in 74, we gave them out. And they took their exams in blue books. 400 exams times four. I had 1,600 blue books to read. Students went one. How do I do, professor? I'm still reading blue books. That was more effective. Today it's multiple guests. But it was like yesterday, I mean, the exam started at 10 o'clock. It's just 15 minutes. It's 10 to 11, and I clap my hands. All right, class, bring up your blue books, the exam is over. And 400 students came up and they put the blue books on the stage. Except one dude in the back, way in the back. I'm watching him. He's not moving, man. He just continues to write in his blue book. I'm watching him, and my PCC, my premature cognitive commitment, is saying, cheater, cheater. That's my bias. So now it's 11 o'clock, and the students are leaving, and I'm up at the stage picking up the blue books, and he comes running up, Professor Geller, don't forget my blue book. I looked the kid square in the eyes, and I said, keep it, son. He said, what? I said, son, this is not the first exam. It's the third exam. When I say exam over, it's over. You just took 10 extra minutes. Besides, I said, I bet you're a failure avoider. You're not a success seeker. You're not working to gain a positive grade. You were working to avoid a negative grade. And he said, I'm not sure I understand what you said. But my mother will kill me if I flunk psychology. That's what I mean. That's exactly what I mean. I can't take your blue book. He tried one more time. He said, sir, what if I just erased everything I wrote in the last 10 minutes? Wouldn't that be fair? I say, absolutely fair if I trusted you. I don't trust you. You tried to beat the system once. You'll try to beat the system again. I can't take your blue book. He was down, man. His head was down. And he started to walk out of the classroom. And then he did something I could not believe. He turned on his heels and he walked up to me with an air of confidence that I could not believe. And he said, sir, do you know who I am? God, that caught me off guard. I said, son, there's 400 students in this class. I don't know who you are. And I don't rightly care. Took his blue book, threw it in the pile with all the rest, ran out of the back of the classroom. That happened. How many have heard that story before? Yeah. Johnny Carson preceded Jay Leno, told that story about a professor in Virginia. You know, he didn't say my name. I'm sorry about that, but the story has been around. How many have seen it on the internet? Yeah, it could have been somebody else now that had that same story, but that happened to me. But let me tell you, that's not the end. And Johnny Carson didn't teach it this way either. I was quick in those days. He threw his blue book under the pile, but I got it. I know who he is. I got his name. What would you do? What would you do? Safety professionals? Huh? Suppose this happened to you. What would you do? How many would flunk them? What? Did you get this on tape? This is not a hand. What? What kind of an example would it be if I let him leave? What? Well, I'm telling you, I couldn't wait to flunk him. Maybe this is a very good crowd, man. I couldn't wait to flunk him. In those days, we didn't have computers, and we had paper. I had this vision, which made me felt good, going to my desk, pulling out the drawer, and looking up his name and giving him an F. Do you have empathy for me? I guess apparently not. On the way back to my office, it's a 10-minute walk, and maybe this is where you are on this. It hit me. What kind of a conversation was that? It was totally top down. It was my way or the highway. I did not take the time to find out where that kid was coming from. Is it possible that he did not hear me call for the end of the exam? Possible, but not probable. Right? 400 students coming up. He knew the... Is it possible, however, that his intentions... Krista brought this up in the Paris... It was not his intention to cheat. Is it possible that he thought he'd just take the extra time, because he was actively caring. He's showing the professor that he knows more than he had the time to tell, and surely the professor will appreciate that. Is that possible?
Yes.
Absolutely. And you know the problem? I don't know. I think he might have taken a calculated risk. How many people take calculated risks from your observations? But you don't take the time to find out what happened. Why did you take the risk? What were the factors? I did not take the time to find out. Tell me, why? About the extra time. By the way, he got a B+ on this exam. The next exam was the final exam. He was the first one to hand it in. He got an A. Got an A- in the class. Here's the kicker. The kid majored in psychology. He majored in psychology after taking introductory psychology. Is it possible that if I had flunked him that day from my biased perception, from my PCC, premature cognitive commitment, is it possible he would have taken a whole different major? Become an engineer and make more money. That's how I learned about empathy. And it was a while. I mean, I was a young professor, but I really learned about, hey, you have to find the other person's side of the story. You have to take the time to be effective. It's not just about being efficient. There's humanistic behaviorism. Krista showed this last hour, but let's just explain what's happening here. We have an activator directing, that's called feed forward. That's a communication, and we have a consequence called feedback that influences the future of the behavior. So this directs people, but it goes through the person who has to perceive it in a certain way. The four R's of non-directive coaching. Perhaps you've heard this before. Remember I said we need to be non-directive. You talk to somebody, they have a problem. Imagine somebody comes into your office and says, hey, you know, I feel I have to quit. This is not the place for me. I'm quitting. This happens sometimes with students. Imagine in a workplace. How do you deal with that? I'm suggesting humanism. I'm suggesting you start. Because here's the deal. You want the person to tell you more of the story. And sometimes they don't tell you more of the story unless you activate more of the story. So sometimes you just repeat. You say you're going to quit? You're going to leave the workplace? Then they'll tell you more. They'll tell you more. Well, I really don't want to quit. But things happened today that really was a turnoff to me. Then you might rephrase. Instead of saying it was a turnoff to you, you would say, so it means that you felt kind of bullied maybe, or what? But the point, you rephrase, or sometimes you ratify. Sometimes you say, you know, I've been there too. I've had days where this place was just not for me, and I'm still here. And then you might help the person reflect. And when that person turns around and says to you, so what should I do? When that person asks you for advice, you know you've been the kind of coach. Instead of directing them to do something, ask enough questions, do enough listening, so they say, so what would you do? What would you do if you were me? Now you're there. But it doesn't happen right away. Let's talk about quickly courage and commitment. Bob Veazey and I actually wrote a novel in my frustration to teach the world through writing. I decided I had to write a novel. And I teamed up with Bob Veazey, who's a real world consultant. And we wrote actually two novels. One is called The Courage to Actively Care, and the other is The Motivation to Actively Care. And all I'm showing you by this is we said that there's a difference between physical courage and moral courage. Physical courage is putting up with a physical handicap. like Lou Gehrig's disease. I had a friend who had Lou Gehrig's disease and completely incapacitated. Can you imagine the frustration of being able to see the world and take in the world, but not being able to do any output? Now that's physical. That's psychological, actually. Moral courage is living up to what you know is right, living up to your morals. That's what safety professionals need to do. You know what's right, you know what's your job, and your challenge is to have the courage to live up. By the way, with a family, with our family, we're right there with telling them what to do for safety. Well, there's no hesitation. You see a family member in a vehicle not buckled, but do you say the same thing to a cab driver? Or to somebody else, a stranger? What I'm trying to say here is, how much courage does it take? It takes more courage the more disconnection you have with the people. What's the lesson here? The more relationship connection you have with the people, the more your workplace is like family, the less courage it takes to show actively caring for people behavior. Krista showed this last, but I'll just quickly go through. These are some things that took some courage. As Krista confessed last presentation, she didn't want to do this. She didn't want to hold a card up so the driver, who was not buckled, this was in the 80s, so only 80% of the people or less were buckled up. She didn't want to do it, but her sister, who was 3.5, she did it. And if the person buckled up, she flipped the card over to say thank you. And to some extent, that took some courage. There's the data, by the way. Just want you to see that these are a variety of people who were showing the flashcard. And we actually had 24%, as high as 27. The average is 24%. These are people who were not buckled up, and all it took was a reminder. And again, Krista had that point last lecture, that sometimes we just need a reminder. We want to do well, but I forgot. Don't assume that they're at risk or that they're not following the rules. They just needed a reminder. By the way, you'll notice here, Christiansburg, much less. Male truck drivers sometimes gave my daughter a hand signal. It did not mean right or left turn. What's that mean, Daddy? It means you're number one, honey. They're just using the wrong finger. Then we took this, a few years ago, we took this flashcard on our campus. Now Safety Bell uses about 80%. And we compared that flashcard with that flashcard. So if students and faculty were leaving the parking lot, they were shown click it or ticket, or they were shown please buckle up, I care. And I was trying to collect data. Remember, it's all about data, to demonstrate that this one works better. And it did. It did. Here's the Flash for Life, pretty large sample size. By the way, these are the 20% who were not buckled up. Not everybody saw the flashcard, only if you weren't buckled up. And this is a significant difference between the positive and the not so. And also we got some negative hand gestures. And we got some more positive expressions here. And we got some more negative expressions here. And this was evaluated by two observers watching this. This was published, so this had to hold up to certain standards for publication. Krista talked about this for 17 years. I gave this blue card on the airline. It took a little bit of courage, man, to hand this the flight attendant this card. I want them to make this announcement. Now that you worn a seat belt, now I use the word seat belt because that's the word they use, the flight crew would like you to buckle up during your ground transportation. And I also tried an incentive. If you say the announcement, after you read the buckle up reminder, a passenger will give you a coupon redeemable for various prizes. So now I added an incentive to saying, maybe you're interested in the data. This is 17 years of data. Look, here's baseline. This is just an activator. Please say the announcement. Then we switched to the incentive. Don't tell me incentives don't work. Now it increased from 37% to 54%. But then people were telling me, well, maybe it's the culture that's changed, because this is a timeline. This is back in 85. Maybe in 94, 95, 10 years later, maybe the culture changed. So then I had to change the methodology. From this point on to the end, sometimes I randomly pulled out either the incentive card or the non-incentive card, same data, 53% with the incentive, 33%. I think the message here is sometimes we just need to collect data. You guys are out in the field. That's easy stuff to collect. Let me show you this one. Do you have the courage to use this? This is a feedback card for taxi cabs or bus drivers or whatever. You're driving in the taxi cab and you see, yes, use your safety belt. During this trip, you use your turn signal for 3 out of 49 turns. Whatever, you fill this out. And then you summarize it right here. And when the trip is over, do you have the courage to give the cab driver feedback? You start out by thanking them. Thank you, sir or ma'am. You are a professional. In fact, to drive in this traffic out here, you have to be a professional. Thank you. Now, can I give you some feedback? People don't like that word feedback. Isn't it so sad that feedback sounds negative? I don't want feedback. Practice doesn't make perfect. Only with feedback can we do better. They usually say, what do you mean? And I say, well, I've been watching you drive. And I've been collecting some data. And I got this feedback card. And I give it to them. And then they say, what should I do with this? And I say, well, it's for you. As a reminder that there's always room for improvement. And then they say, and who are you? This is all before I've given them their gratuity, actually. And who? I say, I'm just a concerned citizen. Now, I'm asking you this question. Do you have the courage to do that? You certainly have the intention. You certainly know it's useful. All right, I stop at 5 o'clock. So I'm going to go quickly here, but this is very important. Self-motivation. Choice. When you give people the perception, and by the way, this cartoon says, man, do we have this guy controlled? Every time we pull the lever, he gives us a food pellet. So the point is, who is in control? It's reciprocal. It doesn't have to be top down. We influence each other. Competence. I better hold back positive attention. Bobby's getting a big head compliment one more time. I mean, when I was a kid, they used to say, don't give him too much positive regard. Have you ever heard that? Anybody here get too much positive regard for the good things you do? I don't think so. But positive regard leads to a perception of competence and thus self-motivation. And then how about community? Big C word, sense of community. I'd share my crackers with you, but I'm afraid I'd create a cycle of interdependency. Exactly. If you want to know more about self-motivation, please watch my TED talk, TEDx talk. It's 15 minutes. I recommend you show this to a work group. It's just 15 minutes. And then after you show it, talk about it. Okay, the professor has these principles, research-based principles, on how you get people to be self-accountable, self-motivated, self-persuaded. How can we take this in our workplace? In our family. I'm proud to tell you, I will soon reach 7 million views since it was posted. The average is about 10,000 people worldwide watch this little simple 15-minute. Why do they watch it? Not because I'm such a great presenter, because the topic is so important and the information is so useful. Okay. I'm moving on quickly. Commitment means choice, active, public. I'll show you a picture. There's me signing the Declaration of Interdependence at Delta Airlines. And it was public. In fact, there it was, Declaration of Interdependence, and I walked up, and other people walked up and signed that. They tell me it's still hanging in their break room in Atlanta. Promise card. You want to get people to do the right thing? Ask them to make a promise. We had people on our campus take the pledge. This was, again, back in the 80s. And they would hang the pledge in their vehicles to remind them that they made the pledge to buckle up. Again, this is just a commitment. Let's just say a word about empathy. Those are two individuals trying to relate to a dog who had to wear that cone. And Chris already showed that. I'm going to go through this quickly. I'm going to go through this. There's going to quote quickly. I want you to substitute the platinum rule for the golden rule. Now, what's the golden rule? The way you want to be treated. Think about that. What if they don't want to be treated the way you want to be treated? Huh? So the platinum rule is treat others the way they want to be treated. But that takes empathy. Embrace and practice empathy. Now I'm back to the summary slide again. So we end on time. But let's review again. What am I saying? It's all about communication. You influence culture by your communication, and the culture influences you and your communication. And courage. Sometimes it takes courage to step to the plate, you know? And commitment. Make it active. Ask people, how many are committed to do this? Raise your hand or sign a pledge. But make it choice. You don't have to sign this pledge. It's your choice to sign this or not to sign it. And again, please, remember these three words, folks. If you want people to be self-motivated, to go beyond the call of duty, perception of choice, competence, and community. I'm going to go through these quickly. Well, Krista told you about the wristband. You all got a wristband. I at least have to show you that the wristband, how that works. Let me just show you. This is Terry Bradshaw's wearing a wristband, by the way. Michelle Obama got a wristband from our Vice President of University Affairs wearing a wristband. One of my students, he was in a wheelchair all his life. And Michelle Obama, 2012, quoted, Justin Graves has committed himself to helping at least one person every day. As he put it, life is all about what you have done for other people. There's a cadet. He's got a wristband. He's out of uniform. There's just one picture of some of my students. And all our research is about how do we increase actively caring for people. And there's Krista's son. I don't have time to do this, so I want to end with my favorite quote of all time. And he's wearing a wristband. In this era of social transition, the greatest tragedy is not the blurring noisiness of the so-called bad people. It's the appalling silence of the so-called good people. If you see something, say something. You've heard that till you're tired of hearing it. But it is about stepping to the plate to make a difference. And I'll end with a poem. And I'm inspired by you all. You waited till 4 o'clock to come to this session. Here's the poem. It's short. A tiger met a lion while drinking by the pool. Said the tiger to the lion, "Why you roar like such a fool?" "Roaring's not so foolish," said the lion with a twinkle in his eyes. "They call me the king of beasts, and it pays to advertise." A rabbit overheard the lion, ran home like a streak. He thought he'd try the lion's trick, but his roar was just a squeak. So a hungry fox had his lunch in the woods. The moral of the story is, it does not pay to advertise unless you've got the goods. That's why you're here, folks. To get the goods. And I urge you one thing. Please, think of science. I'm going to end with my most frustrating feeling right now. Marketing wins over profound knowledge. Marketing wins. it's not your fault, it's just the way it is, but we're into marketing. Use, maybe it's your common sense, but ask. If someone sells you a program or a process, ask this question: where's the data? Thank you very much, folks.